Well, good morning, everybody. Welcome to Christian Worldview with Tony and Austin. Happy Monday morning to you. Hope you had a great weekend, and I hope you enjoyed church, if that's the thing that you do. I hope it's the thing you do, because it's the thing that Christians do, is they gather themselves together, and they forsake not that assembling. So glad you're with us this morning. We're looking forward to a great week, 10 hours of Christian Worldview this week. It's just me today. Tony's in hell. Tony's in Florida. Yeah, sorry about that. Same thing, kind of, but at least, well, I have a grudge against Florida, okay? I mean, for one thing, I don't know how people can live there, particularly in the summer. Like, is literally beyond, the human tolerance for heat and humidity there. It's just too much. But then my gripe is a little more personal, that my pastor, who was on his way to becoming my favorite pastor, but came in second because he resigned and moved to Florida. And I just can't imagine why. I've spent the last 7 months just trying to figure out why somebody would voluntarily resign from a church in upstate South Carolina, relatively rural church in upstate South Carolina, and go to Hobe Sound, Florida.
Maybe he has some family members there.
So what? I ain't got no family here. And I'm not leaving. Try and drag me away.
Where do the grandkids come around? Wherever the grandkids go.
He doesn't have grandkids.
He'll be there. Well, I don't know.
He's my age.
Maybe he's from Florida.
No, Gary, there's no argument. I understand that. I don't know why you wouldn't just default.
Loves the beautiful weather. He is an alligator aficionado.
They don't even really have any good football teams down there. Well, no, neither do we up here now.
Nah.
Oh my goodness.
Nah.
You know, it's very discouraging. I don't have a television, which I think is for the best. And so I don't watch any live football games. If I get them, I got to go back and look for them on YouTube later. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, Saturday I'm out working because 6 days shalt thou labor. This 5-day work week is a Western luxury good. Okay. So you're supposed to work 6 days. The Bible says that 6 days shalt thou labor. We tend to focus on that seventh day and say, but the seventh day you're supposed to rest. And we pretend like that's the emphasis of the commandment. Well, the commandment starts with 6 days shalt thou labor. Good. Glad I got that out of my system. All right, so I work all day on Saturday, and I come home at 6 or 7 o'clock, you know, and I pick up either the computer or my phone and look at the news, and I was looking. I wanted to know if Clemson had won. You know, North Carolina State just seems like it's a pretty straightforward win for them. Yeah, it's not like that. That's not the world we live in anymore. You know, men are not. You can't take gender for granted anymore, and you can't take Clemson winning against North Carolina for granted anymore. It's a very discouraging, disheartening world. Speaking of which, though, see, I've asked this question before, and it's a super important one to me, and it might be, I stand vulnerable to a charge of disingenuity here, okay? And you could say, why are you asking this question? You, of all people, Austin Barker, born in Iowa, raised in Oregon, implant in South Carolina, how could you, you know, legitimately ask this question? But I want to know what does it mean to be a Southerner? Because this question has niggled with me, because I'm a little bit frustrated by the fact that I've been told that I can never become a Southerner because I wasn't born here. And I don't know what the criteria is, okay? I think being born here is the criteria. And maybe having 3 generations back is the criteria. So you can't, until you hit that 3rd generation, you can't legitimately claim yourself as a Southerner. And I resent that a little bit because I fit in better here. Like, this is, the South is more me. I'm more like this than a lot of people that live here and that were born here and that were raised here and that have 3 generations back here. Like, I'm more like what I would consider to be, I embody Southern values, okay, the Southern way of life. And it's an important question to me because I feel like this, I feel like Southern culture, and that needs definition, exactly what I'm talking about, but I'm talking about the good elements of it, okay? Because there are a couple things that are like, yeah, I could do without. But the good stuff that makes the South distinct is under threat. And I think it's fading. And I think that some of that is just kind of by cultural osmosis. It's just moving on. And the universal, ubiquitous access to television kind of blurs the lines between cultural distinctives and regional distinctives, because, you know, everybody kind of starts to talk the same way when you hear these news anchor voices and all the voices that you're hearing, the linguistic influences on you are more California or Midwestern or just sanitized, okay? And so the Southern accent is one thing that is being lost. Now, I don't have a Southern accent, okay? I have a few colloquialisms that I like to use that are distinctly Southern, and I use them because I like them, and I think they do something really good. As a linguist, I can say that. But it's more than that. It's more than just the accent. There is something really important about the way that the South does relationships and that they do interaction with people, both in public and in personal relationships, that is very distinct from the North, from the West, from the Midwest, and from Florida. Because I'm not putting Florida geographically should be Southern, but Florida is not Southern. Okay, it's not one of the Southern states. I say that because they don't share a culture. They don't share Southern culture. Georgia, yes. Mississippi, Alabama, yes. Louisiana, yes. Arkansas, yes. Missouri, yeah, partly. South Carolina, North Carolina, Virginia, West Virginia, all that. Kentucky, Tennessee, all that, yes. But not Florida.
You need to go to the panhandle sometime. You'll find the South there in the panhandle of Florida.
Okay.
But the further south you go, you're in another country.
Or at least you're in a different culture.
Well,
for sure.
It was weird. I visited my daughter who lives in Homestead, which is south of Miami, and that's hard to be.
Wow.
I went to get ice for my grandson's birthday party. We needed ice. I went to the convenience store. I am the seventh person in line. When I finally get to the cash register, I'm the first person speaking English.
Oh, wow.
That's all stuff. And I'm thinking, I think I'm an American.
Wow.
Anyway.
You know, that could be true in Pickens County, though. You're standing at a hot spot and you go, you know, you're the seventh person. By the time you get there, you could well be the first person speaking a recognizable version of English.
That's a different, anyway. You could combine those two.
So I think that Southern culture is not only being diluted, it is actually being attacked, and it's always been scorned, okay, to some extent. You know, I mean, we're the favorite whipping boy of TV ever since, I don't know, ever since probably there was TV. You know, I mean, if you want to make somebody stupid, give them a Southern accent. That is fortuitous. Like, that's just a given. But I think that even that culturally, Southern pride now, being a pride of place, is something that older people do. Like, there's a perception, a generational perception, where Southern pride is something that's for, you know, people in their 40s or above. Because I don't know, I've taught high school, I've taught middle school, I've taught hundreds of students here in the upstate, and hundreds, literally. And I just don't get, but just from a few, the sense that they understand and value what it means to be from the South. And I think that's a departure. Now, listen, I've only been here since 2013. I had friends here from Louisiana and the Deep South. My closest friends were from the Deep South since 2001. So I've kind of always had that, I say always, since 2001, since I became an adult, I've always had that Southern influence. And frankly, without having lived in it and experienced it and understood it, I didn't have the respect for it or appreciation that I do now. Like, my friend would always, you know, he had this fierce patriotism for the South. And I was just like, dude, get over the Civil War, all right? Because that was like 130 years ago, now 150. And he'd always say, you know, dude, it's not about the Civil War, okay? It's about a way of life. And now I get that, okay? And I totally agree with that, and I promote that. I didn't understand what he meant then. Now I do. Now he lives, my particular friend that I'm talking about, lives in Idaho in the West, and I live in South Carolina, and our roles have flipped. So I think that what we're going to have to do is we're actually going to have to teach explicitly what we used to could take for granted. Did you hear that? That phrase right there comes from the South. What we used to could. Okay, that's not something that they say in Iowa or Oregon, I don't think. We used to could take Southern culture and Southern manners and Southern hospitality and Southern way of life for granted. And at some level, in the same way that we want to communicate our Christian values to the next generation, we're going to have to teach them explicitly what it means to be a Southerner. So Southern culture has a reputation for, I mean, there's this phrase, Southern hospitality. And whatever you think of that and however you define that, it's a fading thing. At least it's not what it used to be. And let me give you an example of what I mean when I say Southern hospitality, because to me, Southern hospitality is just emblematic of something that much larger that's true of Southern culture. But you see it most easily, or at least quite easily, in the hospitality thing. So you're entertaining a house guest, a dinner guest, and you're eating, say, name the food. Maybe we could do fried chicken, but I don't think that would really fit in the story because it's something that would require ketchup. Okay? And as the host, you haven't put ketchup on the table. What are you to do as the guest if you want ketchup, but it's not on the table? Because that varies from south to west. Let me tell you how it sounds in the West. If there's no ketchup on the table and you would prefer ketchup on whatever dish is being served, you say, do y'all have ketchup? Or actually you would say, do you guys have ketchup? Or is there ketchup? Or could I have some ketchup? You might say please, you might not. Now, that would be an incredible insult in the South to ask for something that the host has not provided on the table. Am I wrong? Because it shows a level of discontent and a disposition to put your wants above the feelings of the host. Like it would be an unkindness to say that you have not provided something that I want, because it's super important in Southern culture to accommodate your guest as fully as possible. And I think that's super, super wonderful. Like, I think that's such a gracious impulse to want to meet every single need and want of your house guest. And so here it would be insulting to say you haven't done that. You haven't met the standard of meeting my every need. But out west, it would be an insult if the host found that you had got to the end of the meal and had wanted ketchup during that meal and didn't ask for it. They would be like, you dummy, you stupid, why didn't you ask for ketchup? I didn't even know you wanted it. Now that sounds really coarse to a Southerner. And that's the reputation that Westerners and Northerners have, is that they're rude. They're coarse. They just have no manners. But out there, it would be a compliment. And by out there, I'm saying west of the Rockies, okay? That to me is what's west. There's this misperception here that North Dakota is west, okay? That Wisconsin is out in the west, or even that Nebraska is out west, okay? Out west means west of the Rockies. Anything that's east of the Rockies is Midwest, all right? So when I say out there, I'm talking about where I was raised in Oregon. So if you want ketchup, it is a compliment to the host to say, can I go get some ketchup? No, not can I have some ketchup, but can I go get some ketchup? What that conveys is that you're so comfortable in this setting, in this social setting, you're so comfortable with this person, your friendship is such that it can tolerate you actually getting up and going to the refrigerator. You feel so much at home that you would go into the refrigerator and act like it's your own place. Like when they say, make yourself at home, they actually mean if you want something out of the refrigerator, get it. It would be very inelegant here in the South to actually go to someone else's refrigerator, open it up, and get something out of it. That's an insult. I think of that as an insult. But not in the West. That's a compliment. Isn't that strange? Coffee is another great example. At the end of a meal, here in the South, it's customary to offer coffee to your dinner guests. Anybody want coffee? That's a general question. It's kind of served up for anybody. And the polite response to that is, oh, no, no, I'm fine. And then a few minutes later, the host will offer again. Would anybody like coffee now? Does anybody want coffee? Oh, I'm fine. I might take some a little bit later, but I'm fine. And then that third offer of coffee comes, and it's, would you like coffee now? Can I get you some coffee? And it says, and the polite response is, well, if you're going to make it for somebody else, but don't make it just on my account. If you already got some going, I might take a cup. And then the host goes and makes coffee. And both parties are happy. Now, what goes on in the West, because relationships in the West are very transactional, that's what gives it the perception of coarseness, of abruptness, is that they're much more practical. They don't regard social grace as a prime virtue. I do. But it's the let's get this thing done impulse that makes them, when they offer coffee to you in the West, you'd best take it on the first offer, because it sounds like this. Does anybody here drink coffee after your meal? And if you say no to that, you're not saying, I'd like coffee later after you offer it to me for the third time. What you're saying is, I don't typically drink coffee after my meal. I'm not a coffee drinker. So what they're asking you is a different question. I mean, you're being offered coffee after the meal. It feels like it's the same thing. But what you're really being asked is something different. Here in the South, it's, would you like coffee at some point in this evening? And out there, it's, are you a coffee drinker? So that's what I'm talking about, the differences. I don't know that there's a way to necessarily say, to like morally evaluate those two and to say one is better than the other. But based on the fact that my family creed says that civility is the lubricant of society, I believe that the Southern social graces contribute more to a well-lubricated society where there's less potential for conflict. It's the same way that we do social criticism. We temper it with kindness. And it's not, this is where the hypocrisy component comes in, is the bless your heart impulse, but it's not a hypocrisy. It's a lubricant. It's a way to soften the blow that you're going to land. Where in the West, there's no impulse to soften the blow. They're very blunt. They're very straightforward would be the way to put it in a more positive light. They are very direct. And when I get around people like that, I'm uncomfortable. And I like my Southern friends because they are circumspect and they do try to soften blows. And so I wish that I could tell you that I knew exactly how to connect this concept of Southern hospitality and Southern civility, manners, with a Christian worldview. Because I think that the world that we live in here in the South is a better one. And I think that we're losing it. And that's why I'm concerned about it. And so I think that it needs to be made explicit. Like, this is what it means to be a Southerner. This is why it's good. And this is how you do it. I mean, it's things like teaching your kids to put an honorific before an adult's name. You don't ever call an adult by their first name. But when we moved, I was raised to call my aunts and uncles by that. Aunt, this. Aunt, first name. Uncle, first name. And grandparents were grandpa, last name, and grandma, last name. And adults were always Mr., last name. Like that was, or brother in the church, brother, last name. Here in the South, we do the Mr. first name or Miss first name, which is okay. I'm okay with it because it's still the honorific impulse. It's still a title with some respect. I prefer probably Mr. last name, Mrs. last name, because that helps me distinguish between the Mrs. and the Miss, which is a distinction that I find helpful. But when I went out West, I called my aunt I'm 7 years old, and I called my 30-something-year-old aunt. I called her Aunt Christy. And she, I remember it like it was yesterday. She looks at me and she says, just Christy, fine. Just Christy's fine. And I could never reconcile to that. I refuse, because when I call somebody, you know, when somebody calls me Mr. Barker, you will never hear Austin Barker saying, no, just Austin, please. Mr. Barker, that's my dad. That makes me feel old. It's like, okay, I'm 38 years old. At what point do you assume your role as an adult in the world and start accepting the title that goes along with it? So when I hear adults here in the South push for the dropping of these titles and the honorific that comes before their last name, I'm like, are you really, really sure that you want less respect in the world? Like, that's one of the things that's true about Southern culture, is that we respect our elders. There's a baseline respect for elders here in the South that is not true in the North. Like, it's a much more disposable culture, and I feel like old people are not as respected in the North and the West as they are here in the South. I love that about the South, because that is biblical, that there's wisdom that comes with age, and you better defer to that. You better show that respect. They've been around this, around the block a time or two or 20, and you better respect that. And I think we're losing that. I think that, and part of that is just this immature, I don't want to feel old thing. Not on my watch. What music? You know, like country. You ever heard of country music? Why is so much of country music about the South? Well, it's because there's two different things, actually. It used to be called, some people call it country western music. It's actually, originally it was called country and western music. And those are two very different things. Like, if you listen to western music, it's more like folk music. It's more like, you know, Sons of the San Joaquin or Sons of the Pioneers. It's more about tumbleweeds and, you know, rodeos and horseback riding and the prairie. And that's not stuff that's true about the South. If you want to talk about the South, you know, talk about pine tree forests and the wind and the, you know, singing Dixie in the pines. That's the South, you know. So those are two separate things. And as rap music gains more and more cultural penetration, market penetration here in the South, I mean, listen, just go and ask a room of 30 high schoolers what kind of music they listen to. I bet 28 of them right now listen to rap music. It's certainly in the 20s. It's way over 50% of kids now listen to rap music as their dominant genre. And to me, that is extremely corrosive to a Southern ethic. Because that's not how we roll down here. That's an urban, that is an inner city urban genre of music. That's where it was born, and that's where it lives, and that's where it wants to live. I don't want to live in rural upstate South Carolina. I'm sorry. Ain't nobody got time for that. Some things are worth fighting for. Southern culture's one of them. But this story from Fox News tells another thing that's worth fighting for, worth beating somebody's face in for, worth cracking somebody's skull over. And I wonder if you agree. I will tell you that I'm conflicted, because from a Christian worldview perspective, I don't know how to handle this. But from an Austin Barker and a dad of six standpoint, I know exactly how to handle this. So the headline is, Oklahoma dad hops into action when he sees man touching boy inappropriately at bus stop. The subheading, the boy's father staked out the bus stop before tackling the suspect. So here's the story. Tell me what you think of this story. A father in Oklahoma City tackled a local pastor who was seen inappropriately touching his son at a bus stop, leaving the suspect, that's the pastor, with a cracked skull and a bloody mugshot. And I'm looking at the bloody mugshot. It is quite gruesome.
There are hardly any words, but she said there's hardly any words that are camera appropriate, witness Lisa Ward said of the incident. It's just sickening.
So that's a whole distraction for me anyway, and I won't get distracted, but if the words are not camera appropriate, they're just not appropriate. Okay? So why are we letting the FCC determine what words are appropriate and which ones are not? Let's say, well, anyway, I told you I wouldn't get distracted on that. Someday I will. Oklahoma City police arrested the suspect, Michael Coghill, on Wednesday after he was recorded on camera touching a 9-year-old boy at a bus stop and was confronted by the boy's father. The police department, however, could not confirm to Fox News that the boy's father was the one to confront the suspect due to the Open Records Act. Local residents said that Coghill is a local pastor in the area. So let me summarize the rest of the story. The boy told the police that this pastor, Coghill, would often jog near the bus stop and that he had stopped nearby on more than one occasion. And he said the boy, that is, the 9-year-old boy, said that this pastor, Coghill, had visited the bus stop on Monday and had touched him in a way that made him feel uncomfortable. And the boy also told his parents about the incident. So his father, the 9-year-old's father, accompanied the boy to the bus stop on Wednesday and sat in his car waiting to see if this jogging pastor would make his appearance. And he did. So as the boy made his way to the bus stop, Coghill stopped his jog and approached the boy and then touched him in an inappropriate way. And the father came over and beat his face in. What do you think of that? He was in the cop car all bloody, said a witness. You think that's the right response from a Christian? To beat a pastor's face in who's touching your son inappropriately? I'll pause that question because I've got a couple callers and I have a feeling like they might want to answer a question I asked earlier or make a comment about something I asked earlier. So, Joan, welcome to the program this morning. How are you?
Fine. How are you?
Well, thank you.
I'm fine.
Good.
I did want to comment on what you had said earlier about the culture here in the South.
Yeah.
To be honest, I had already written you off.
Is that right?
Because I thought you were too critical. And what you said this morning helps me realize that you have insight and you're very thoughtful about what you say and the way you perceive things. And I love you now.
Well, I love you too, Joan.
Because I did not realize where you grew up. And that was the first that I had. I just catch bits and pieces of his show.
Yeah.
Going to work.
Yeah.
And, but to know that, you know, that gave me insights into how I'm different than other people because I grew up around here.
Wow.
And I never really thought about that, about us being so different than the West Coast or people that are from the North. And that's why we get angry a lot of times with what they say because we just have a completely different perspective on things. So thank you for telling us that.
Well, Joan, let me ask you before you go.
I'm 66 years old, and I have a lot to learn.
Well, let me ask you. I'm interested to know, and if you'll excuse me for asking this question, what was it that turned the corner? You said that you'd written me off because I was critical. What part of it was it? My description telling you kind of why Westerners are the way they are, and that it's not necessarily just rudeness that makes them. Is that kind of what you've seen in me? Is you've seen that Western what Southerners would perceive as rudeness?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And one thing, too, is that I think now you are identifying with us Southerners.
Oh, definitely.
So that turned the corner for me.
No.
You did not grow up around here, but you actually like the way we are.
I love it here. I'm here by choice.
That turned the corner for me.
Wow. Well, I am so glad you called. You've just given me goosebumps this morning, and what a wonderful call. Will you call again now? Because you're my new favorite listener.
Okay, thank you.
Have a good day. We'll talk to you.
One of my favorite talkers.
You're very kind. Well, thank you. Take care. All right, Jim, good morning. Welcome to the show. How are you?
Good morning. I enjoy when you're doing the program and you're sharing your thoughts because you're not always talking about what the current thing is, which would almost wear out, like the vaccine and all.
Yeah.
I agree with what you're saying. I was born and raised in Washington, D.C. And I noticed the culture there. And when I got married, I moved to Nashville. So 25 in D.C., 25 in Nashville, now 25 in Chattanooga. It's fun to watch the difference in the cultures. I'm almost 80 years old, and my hair is growing crazy. I have two cowlicks in the back. Relating what you're talking about with culture, I don't like the looks of my hair.
Uh-huh.
I'm very self-conscious and conservative. So I have a tendency to wear a white hat, you know, like a baseball hat,
mm-hmm.
everywhere I go. And when I go inside, I want to wear the hat inside. And my culture says you take the hat off at the door.
Yeah.
So it's kind of tough for me to break the culture. I went to a funeral of my brother's yesterday, and I wanted to wear my hat in the church. I said, no, you got to take it off, Jim.
Mm-hmm.
And I think where this is affecting us, where you're going with it is, when we're talking about this virus and the vaccine and stuff, we're coming together with different cultures as to what we can say. Do you notice that also?
Oh, yes.
We get angry when we should just be freely talk about it. One of the things that I feel like has made this country so come together, and we had the freedom of our thought to say what we say, the freedom of speech. Where in Europe, they came from where they didn't have the freedom. Either the priest or the religious person or the king told them what they could think. When we got here, we didn't like that. So it made us great because we would do that. Now, we made a mistake because when slavery came along, we didn't want to make an issue out of it. But felt one thing in the South, felt another. You understand what I'm saying?
Yeah, Jim, I'm so curious about what you're saying because you've said you're almost 80. You're 70 some odd years old. And
78.
Yeah, so I have to give your perspective some credibility that I don't have because I've only witnessed firsthand, I've only witnessed the cultural changes within the last three decades. And you've watched this happen over six or seven decades now. And for you to say things are different than they used to be, I've got to listen to that. And I don't...
My family came out of Virginia into Washington, D.C. to be city people instead of farmers.
Mm-hmm.
And I started noticing a difference. And one of the differences, we had a neighbor right next door to us where we rented. And then the person who we rented from was two houses over. And Mr. Geisenow would say, why can't you call me by Cecil?
Hmm.
You call Rit by his first name.
Mm-hmm.
And so we saw the difference. That's where I began to notice the difference. But as you're saying, what I'm seeing were the changes here in the South, where they're very self-conscious about being nice to people. And when you're my guest, I do those things. And I feel the same what you said about the ketchup. I go to my daughter's house. The ketchup isn't on the table. I don't want to ask her because it shows she forgot to put it on.
Yeah.
And yeah. I don't mean that. But society is meaning that, like you're telling out west.
Yeah.
And I've been out west where my in-laws moved to.
Mm-hmm.
It's a different thing out there.
It is.
Almost feel like that somehow this country should have that program again where the youth travel around the country to see the scenery and to see the different cultures.
Hmm.
Another thing that I noticed about cultures is the accent that we have. And it hit me one day. The reason we have the different accents from different parts of the country is simple. It's where that nationality, the Germans were coming in the north, maybe the Spanish were here in the south, and somebody else is a different part of the country. And when we didn't have radios back then, they talked what the people talked where they came from. Now that we have radio and television, we talk more like each other.
Yeah.
But we still have those cultures, so I appreciate you bringing that up because I think that's one of the problems we're running into today. As an example, I was listening to a program last night. Now, everybody's saying it's conspiracy. I don't believe it's conspiracy because the people who are telling about it, they've studied germs, they've studied different things, and they're telling us that in these different vaccines, something else in there that's going to affect us down the road. But the culture thing, as you're saying, is getting to the place it's hard to say something because we're being mean. We're not being mean. We're trying to discuss this. If there is something in this vaccine that's long-term, it's scary when you stop and realize when they're feeding that stuff to the military, are we going to have a military where we can't find enough people? And I'll end with this one last one. If it's true that they're trying to control us, I heard something yesterday that scared me. My daughter and my wife were saying, living in West Virginia, they can't find that rubber ring that goes on canning jars. They're trying to control us by if we can can we won't have to have them controlling us because we got our own food. Do you understand what that's saying?
Well, I don't agree with it, but I understand what your point.
We won't be able to
canned
food so we can take care of ourselves.
Yeah,
again, this culture comes into it.
Don't live in fear of that type of stuff, Jim. Don't go down that road. But hey, listen, always good to hear from you. I got to go. I got one other caller that I want to get in quick before the break. Benita, am I saying your name right? And good morning.
Benita, yes, sir.
Perfect.
Good morning to you as well.
Thank you.
I just wanted to share, first off, that I've been listening to his radio for close to 20 years, Pawleys Island and Hilton Head Island. And no, I'm in Florida down here with all these.
Oh, I'm sorry to hear that.
And it is hotter. It is hotter here than I anticipated.
No doubt.
But I do miss the Live Oaks. But anyway, I wanted to share with you something kind of funny. You said goosebumps earlier when you were talking to the lady.
Yeah.
And I have to tell you, they're called God bumps.
Goosebumps. Okay.
God bumps. That's what I call them.
That's interesting. I've heard them called goose pimples before. Have you ever heard them called goose pimples?
I have not. Huh. When I used to live up in Virginia, we called them goosebumps. But since I've been in the South for so many years, we call them God bumps.
G-O-D, God bumps?
Yes, God bumps, G-O-D.
I'm going to have to look that up. I've never heard that before. That is interesting. Man, I'm a sucker for regional linguistic variation. I minored in linguistics in college. And so there's actually a New York Times a dialect survey. If you go to Google and just do a Google search, New York Times dialect survey, you will just absolutely have a blast with the regional variations, and it will pinpoint your linguistic influences with like 90% accuracy. It's crazy how it gets it. Anyway, go look it up. I think you'll enjoy it.
Yeah, I'll do it because it's rather interesting when people say, "Oh, I got goosebumps." I say, "I have got."
Good to talk to you, Benita. Thanks. Take care.
You as well. Thank you.
All right. So often the case is that when I read a story, a whole range of thoughts occur to me in response to that story, and then my job is to try and sift those thoughts and reject those thoughts that come from my flesh, and to embrace those thoughts that come from the Spirit. And by the Spirit, I'm capitalizing S there. I'm talking about the Holy Spirit and the Holy Spirit that lives within me and suggests to me the appropriate ways to think for a Christian. That's why we call the show The Christian Worldview. But as members or as citizens of two kingdoms, of the kingdom of God and the kingdom of man simultaneously, we have dual allegiances and we also have dual responses. And this is what Paul was saying in Romans chapter, I believe it was in Romans chapter 7, where he says, you know, with my mind, with my spirit, I want to serve the Lord, but then I find in my flesh another law within my members warring against my spirit. And so there's this internal struggle, and who you allow to win that struggle is how successful you are at achieving and maintaining a Christian worldview. Maintaining, building, and then maintaining a Christian worldview is very difficult. And it is difficult even for people who are committed to it, because there are stories like the one I read to you earlier, where this father of a 9-year-old boy beat the head in of a pastor who inappropriately touched his kid at a bus stop. What's the Christian response? Now, one of our commenters on Facebook said that the pastor should already be meeting his maker. Okay? So what that's suggesting is that the appropriate response to a man inappropriately touching a 9-year-old boy is to kill him. Okay? Just be frank. Let's just put the score out there. Capital punishment is the appropriate response to that type of behavior. Okay? That's one way of thinking about this. Obviously, that is an instinctive way for me as the father of six, that if you do something to my children, I can't tell you for sure what's going to be the outcome of that. It probably depends on which voice I listen to, because if I listen to the voice of my humanity, if this were my 9-year-old son and I was the father there, I mean, he has video evidence of it. It's not like it's questionable. Okay. Sometimes there are issues of justice where there's not a clear verdict to be had. There's no real ambiguity here about what the verdict is in this case, all right? So whenever you're dealing with a clear violation what do you do with that, and what voice do you listen to? Because I'm just going to tell you that there's biblical thinking and then there's earthly thinking, and I'm not telling you what the right answer is. I'm asking you to think. This is what I always told my students. I'm not telling you what to think on this. I'm telling you to think, all right? And I'm asking you to challenge your instinctive reaction and temper it with a Christian worldview and to say, what is the appropriate response? Do we allow the justice system, do we trust the justice system enough to accomplish justice in this matter? Or do we take justice into our own hands and say, justice will be served because I'll be the one serving it? I'm using this story as an example of a much broader principle of what, how do we accomplish justice culturally as Christians? That's a really, really important question. Now, in this case, it seems to be a little bit more black and white. Like, I have a lot of sympathy for this father, okay? I put in his situation, I'm not going to tell you that I wouldn't have done the same thing. I remember a similar case a couple years ago where there was a father down in Texas who witnessed his best friend sexually assaulting his daughter. The father's daughter, obviously, his best friend was molesting his own daughter. I'm still not saying that clearly, but anyway, so the father of the daughter beat the face in, killed the guy, actually. Killed him with his bare hands. He was not charged with a crime. I don't think he should have been charged with a crime. I think that God has entrusted the protection of my family to me first. And according to the theory, to the doctrine of subsidiarity, government happens best closest to those who are impacted by it. So I don't know. I'm just telling you that there's multiple things to go on here. And let me just remind you that by this shall all men know that you are my disciples, by the love that you have one for another, not by the passion for justice that you have in our culture, not by the fervor with which you defend the right. By this shall all men know that you're my disciples, by the love that you have one for another. Now, I'm not telling you that that means be a doormat. Can you hear me saying two things at one time here? You're like, Austin, you're equivocating. Of course I'm equivocating, because I believe that equivocating is the appropriate response here. I think a univocal response on an issue like this is inappropriate. It's too black and white. You got to think more than one thought at the same time.